Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guests today have created another entry in the fun, campy, improbable monster movies that we all enjoy and love so much. Don Bitters and Jeff Reisner are the writer and co-director of Pterodactyl. And I have to admit that the pterodactyl was one of my favorite dinosaurs when I was a kid. So this one has a little sentimental appeal to me. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Hi. Welcome. Hi there. Great to be here.
So I have to ask, why pterodactyls and how did this come about?
Well, really, it kind of came about, and Jeff, please feel free to speak as well. But basically, we kind of had been trying for years, because we'd been working together on projects since college in Chicago, and we really just wanted to get a feature made. And we knew kind of that at the level we were at, that we had to like do a lot of just get the work done and get the thing going before we could really, you know, have something to show, have something to really present as the feature. So we kind of just made the decision early on to let's just get it done and shoot it. And we knew kind of that we had to make something that would do well financially, but also like feed us our, you know, our own creative interests, because this has like a lot of genesis in like the movies we loved growing up, you know, like Tremors, Ghostbusters, Jurassic Park, and for myself personally too, Evil Dead 2. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of like influences from all these different films that we loved that were, you know, monster movies and essentially even big budget B movies that we loved growing up.
Yeah, it mostly came out of like we had been doing, we'd been developing some short films together. And what's funny was some of these short film ideas that conceptually they started ballooning, like financially, you're getting into higher and higher numbers. And at a certain point in this process, it just became kind of rather than, if you're going to spend this kind of energy and effort and resources to make a short film, you might as well just kind of move towards the direction of a feature, at least something that is going to have a better like end game to it than just having a short to put up online. And so it morphed into this idea of, well, what can we do? As Don said, like very early on, we wanted to do something that we knew was a sellable film. And so we wanted to bring in qualities that would not only be in the genre or the range that we had fun with, that things that, you know, from our childhood, from our experiences growing up with film, but also something that we could present to market that we felt like we had a high degree of confidence that we could sell the film. And then so we kind of built it from the ground up with that in mind. And then that actually blossomed really well because of Don had this idea that he pitched to me. We were at a coffee shop, and I was pitching him a different, like a concept that was like kind of around this area, and we were just having fun with it, you know, joking around. And he said, that reminds me of this crazy idea for a movie that I had come up with, I think in high school. And he's like,
I think it was, stop me if I'm interrupting, but like basically it was, like, I didn't have too much of a concept. It was really just, I have a title. We went from there.
Yeah, and you're like, this title is called Pterodactyl. And I was like, okay. And like, we just started, you know, spitballing about it. And it was mostly jest. Like, it was a lot of, like, joking around about it. Like, for a good, like, 20, 30 minutes, we were just, it wasn't serious. And by the time we left that conversation, by the time, like, it was... there was this, it suddenly somehow went from, this is just a joke. Yeah, that'd be a great title, but it was like the equivalent of, I think when you also were talking about Contra, like making a Contra movie or so. It was just like, it was just so out there. And then by the time we left, it was, and how could we actually do this? Like, this isn't a bad idea. Like, it's actually a pretty good idea. How do we do it?
Yeah, and I think it came from like, after that conversation, like I think even in that like 20, 30 minutes, like joking around, we had roughed out like an overall like idea, and I kind of just went to town on a script and knocked the thing out in like a couple weeks for the first draft. Came back to Jeff again, and you know, we went through a revision process, but very quickly we kind of settled into the idea of like we're actually going to do this. This isn't not just something we're talking about. We're actually going to do this.
Yeah, it got very serious. Once you sent me the script, I knew it was definitely serious that you weren't just pretending to write the script, because I would just get these emails. You'd be like, oh, I'm 15 pages in. I'd be like, all right, yeah, keep going. You know, oh, I'm like 30 pages in. And so once we finally had a script, I was like, all right, now it's actually serious. Now we have to go make this film. And we started bringing in the next round of people, you know, like investors and our producer, and getting all these, starting to pull other people on board and go down this path. So it was a really fun and kind of like just almost out of nowhere project that like suddenly became real and like, you know, 0 to 60 in like a month. So
so the production process became serious, but I've seen the trailers, and from the discussion of from your description of this, the discussion that spawned Don into actually writing this, there's not much serious about the film itself.
It's a comedy, and like that's the thing that we knew we had to do is awesome, because and ultimately, like, and my mentality through a lot of this process was, you know, but write a script that's just so fun to write, and we shoot a movie that's just so fun to shoot, that the hope is that for people watching it, that it's just, it's, there's no way it can't be equally or more fun than it was to make the thing.
Yeah, because I got fascinated by dinosaurs as a kid. I think almost every kid, when you discover dinosaurs, you want to find out more about them. And the pterodactyl was one of my favorites because it looks like it actually can't possibly exist. and then you see the mock-ups of them, you see the skeletons of them in the museums, and you're like, I still don't believe that thing actually could fly. And then some point in time I saw Rodan, Godzilla and Rodan. I'm like, okay, I like this. And then watching the trailers, the teasers for Pterodactyl just brought back all those old memories of Rodan. But the tone of it, believe it or not, the tone of it reminded me of Big Ass Spider, which was just another silly, fun movie. So I'm looking forward to eventually seeing this, but tell me more about the process of designing the monsters, plural, because there are several.
Oh, yeah.
Terrorizing. Why does Los Angeles get all the fun, huh?
Well, we, you know, we live here, you know, Chicago, but it's easy to destroy the place you live. So that was a big factor. But at least like the design of it, and actually the intention is that these aren't actually like the pterodactyls in the traditional sense, like the P-T-E-R. Mm-hmm. These are a new species that we've never seen before, and that's the reason that like they're able to survive and they're back is because they're not just your traditional dinosaur. They're something we've never seen before. And when I was kind of like bringing designs that I was coming up with to Jeff, the intention I always had is like, well, let's have this thing be an amalgamate of all of our favorite dinosaurs. So, I mean, if you look at the things, they've actually got a raptor claw on the eye is actually designed a bit like the T-Rex eye. I mean, obviously the reference that we all kind of pull from is Jurassic Park, but you know, looking at the actual like the way these creatures existed, and then like the another influence that's actually, and I had to like expose people to this unfortunate reality that birds are terrifying. If you actually look at them closely, like bird mouths are just the most horrific thing you could find. Like if you Google it, if you like look it up, like penguin mouths, duck mouths are just horrifying. They have teeth on their tongues. So I pulled a lot from like natural sources like that to help ground this thing so that it would never felt like too far off or too like, you know, fantastic as well.
So how long did it take to actually come up with the design and the, I guess, the motion of it in CGI terms?
I mean, a lot of time. It just because it's not an easy process. It's not like a, you know, one button thing. It's, you have to, I mean, I could bore you with however many steps it is, but basically it's just, there's a lot of like different skills that come into it to make something like that and then make it look real. And we did a few things to help, basically to create like thousands of these. It was much easier to really create one body and multiple heads and then a lot of different what's called materials or textures for the body. So like there's like all these different colors, there's all these different looks, but it's all really the same thing, which made it much easier to generate, like, you know, just thousands or hundreds of them at a time that all look different, even though they're all kind of sourced from the same design.
And that was something also that we kind of, from the ground up, like, we tried to create when we were designing this film, was like, we wanted to have a creature that we could have a lot of flexibility with. Like, we could, if we're going to put pour a lot of R&D into these characters, we want to have the flexibility to engage them in multiple environments and, like, and do that in a way that just, like, allowed us from, like, you know, just, like, from the fact that, like, the budget constraints and, like, you know, we're not, like, a $30 million film where you can design multiple characters and all that kind of stuff. It's, like, how do you stretch that, like, all that R&D and apply it to multiple characters and all that kind of stuff? So there was a lot of thinking that Don, there's a lot of ways that Don came up with, like, how to stretch it all out and give us a lot of flexibility in the film in terms of utilizing the pterodactyls. So that was very helpful.
So what for you guys was the biggest challenge in getting this produced? Because it sounds like you had more fun and more flexibility with the CGI aspects. So was the actual practical filming and setup more of a challenge or less of a challenge?
Definitely. I know that you...
Yeah. I feel like the practical filming was pretty smooth. I'm not sure the actual, I can't really recall the actual number of days we shot. I think it was around like 15 days of principal and maybe like 5 to 7 days of like smaller second unit type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've shot a few features cause I was the cinematographer on this film, as well. So I've done features before. I've done a few features and I've done a lot of shorts and I've been a DP for many years. So I had when we actually shot this back in 2012, like, I had a lot of support in that realm of general, like, doing the actual production. So, there wasn't any like big problems in terms of how to tackle the production. We did an incredible amount of prep in regards to how to accomplish the VFX and the production, all the plate shots, like, because, you know, all the dinosaurs are mostly CG, so it's like, how do you shoot all these? We got to get all this, like, all the plate shots, and, like, there was a lot of incredible amount of prep that went into getting us ready for the production process, and it went pretty smoothly from our end, like, and just in terms of we made our days, we didn't have anything that really disrupted us. Like, one of the bigger challenges really was just getting locations, like getting the right locations that allowed us to tell the story. And that's kind of always been like a big struggle for anybody trying to, especially when you're doing any kind of like low budget science fiction work, is like finding locations that work for your film. And that was something that was probably one of the bigger challenges, but other than that, like a lot of the process went pretty well.
So what is your process, your vision when you're making films? Because I know you have, with an independent film, you have a lot fewer hands on deck to help. Sometimes you have to work faster. What advice would you give a burgeoning indie filmmaker for just helping to have a smooth production, or as smooth as possible?
I think it's kind of like what Jeff has spoken to earlier, is that there's a lot of prep that went into this, and it's something that can't be underscored for anyone trying to make a film, you know, because me and him have both worked on much larger productions, much smaller productions. And the unfortunate thing is that a lot of times the director or, you know, the people on set don't have a plan. And if you don't have a plan, you can't really approach it to know what you're going to get and know how you're going to get that. Because, for example, like a lot of we have several big action sequences in our film, some involving like car chases and trucks and, you know, big gunfights and stuff. And what we ended up doing a lot was, pre-visualization, which is literally we're shooting the movie before we're shooting the movie, doing it all in a computer, kind of just like with really low quality stuff to like figure out, okay, well, we need this shot for this kind of reaction, because we like already shot like interiors of the vehicle. But we knew like the way we're going to get the right thing that matches with the exterior, we kind of just did this pre-visualization so that we could then, on the day of shooting, get exactly the shot we needed to make that work for everything else. And it also helped a lot with getting the right performances and the right kind of just knowing how we're going to structure a day to shoot, because, having overheads, having storyboards, having all those things are great, but you also need to kind of break them down into, well, what's the feasible way to execute on these things? So, I mean, personally, I would say a lot of it is just plan everything you can, but also be prepared for things to change, because things will inevitably go wrong or, not go the way that you'd expected them to. But if you still have something in place, you at least have a starting point in which to figure out a path around the problems or around the issues you're going to run into on the set.
So it sounds like because you're a lower budget independent, it sounds like you have to do more planning to make sure your use of time and money is more efficiently utilized.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is as Don said, a lot of other shows, and I don't think that there's anything wrong with this tactic, but on bigger productions that I've worked on, when you have a lot of money, there's a lot of the same way that me and Don sit down and start working on rewording, let's say, some dialogue in a script, and we're sitting at a coffee shop, we don't really consider it a big deal for us to be doing this, and maybe the expenses of buying the coffee and doing this, not a big deal. And it, when you have a lot of money, that attitude kind of translates the same way, where on a big production where you're maybe spending 20 grand an hour or something like that for the day, they don't have an issue with sitting down and spending an hour rewriting dialogue. And to me, or to anybody with a low budget, they're going, that's crazy. But it's just a mentality that starts to kind of get there when you start having all this money. And when you don't have that, you have to be really careful with how you plan this all out. And that was just something I think we did end up pushing the shoot back once. I think we were planning on, I think we started shooting in April, but initially we were trying to start shooting in March, and we pushed it all back by at least a month. We just needed that extra time, and and that time goes into everything from tweaking the dialogue, doing a little bit more rehearsing, to tweaking some of the blocking. Because Don and I would, one of the things too that in respect to just making things work with a lower budget is going in kind of knowing already how the dynamics of any given scene are going to play out. And that's one of those things that you spend a lot of time on set. Sometimes when I would do a lot of DP work, you would show up and they'd be blocking the scene fresh that day. How are we going to do this? And that's how most people would do things, but we kind of had to do it in pre-production. We had to look at a scene. We had to work out the dynamics of the interactions of the characters and how are we going to block this? Even if there's no action, it's just a talking scene, but where's the power differential between all the characters, and how are we staging it? How are we blocking it? And the more prep we did in that respect means that when we get on set, we just, we're just telling the actors here's the blocking. We're moving through it very quickly and, setting their marks and moving and doing and shooting. And we're able to do a lot of setups in that way. And get through the day well covered, not just scrunching by. So all that prep. Yeah, go ahead.
And also it helps, I think, with a lot of performances too, for the actors to not have to be stressing about hitting their marks or something as much, and really be able to focus on a specific performance or getting a certain kind of beat in the narrative. It helps a lot. And again, it kind of goes back to that planning, because what you're doing is, on an independent film, the one thing you have that big studio films don't have is time, because you're not kind of beholden to these crazy schedules or release dates. So if you're able to invest that additional time into things to make it easier for everyone else to do their job, they're able to, one, focus more on it, but do better work. And I think it shows for what you end up getting on screen and in every other aspect of it, because people are able to just really, really deliver on what they came there to do, versus having to worry about, okay, well, I don't know where I'm supposed to be standing. So who am I talking to? Those questions just don't exist anymore.
So have you guys teamed up on spitballing any new ideas?
There's a bit of back and forth on that too. I'm currently developing a bunch of different scripts, both in sci-fi genre and outside of it. And, you know, we've, you know, early talks of even potentially doing a sequel to this one, which we do set up pretty well at the end. So I won't say the title yet, but I think people, if this film finds its fan base and people enjoy it for what it is, they'll definitely enjoy what we have in mind for future films.
Excellent. Any other final comments for, I guess, those aspiring indie filmmakers who might be listening in?
Yeah, I would say, you know, the biggest thing is to shoot stuff and make content and not to rush into it. You want to have a plan, like we're talking about plans, but I'm very interested in like things like when I see things like Kung Fury on Kickstarter and how that got funded and how it got released and now Kung Fury's on Netflix and like that's amazing to me and I'm very attracted to that, like the idea that if I had a cool idea now I could basically put together a very small trailer pitch and go on Kickstarter and raise money, and even if it's a short film, if it's a cool enough idea in the age of the internet, it's going to get traction, and that is awesome to me. Like it's such an exciting time that really didn't even exist 4 to 5 years ago. I think like it was when we were starting this movie, that wasn't like a thing. Like you couldn't do that, and I think there's just every day like there's more and more options for people to get the resources they need to make projects, because it's always about resources. What resources do you have to bring your film to life and whatever idea you've got? And those resources every single year are getting greater and greater for people. So there's, you know, come up with a plan and just do it and go shoot something and make it.
Pretty obvious thing now, but like the barrier of entry for like getting something made has dropped like huge. Since, like, as Jeff said, like, four or five years ago. And now it's something where, like, if you really want to know how to do visual effects, like, the resources exist online. And, like, you can train, you teach yourself. You can really kind of just, like, learn how to do that stuff. And, you know, as long as you've got the time and you've got, like, the just determination to make something, you can make it. And, you know, if you've really got the talent and the ability to make something good, like, people will get attracted to it. There's just no way around it.
I wish some filmmakers would take advantage of the online opportunities. Like you have a movie, you have a sequel. Why not put out like a 3-part web series that tells like one chapter that happened in between the two movies, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's also what's great about and I keep I'll go to Kung Fury again, is it doesn't have to fit a category anymore. Like what we think of traditionally as a feature film, a lot of that emanates just from like what distribution companies required to sell movies in international territories in terms of like what the length is, the structure, and all these things are built upon certain, you know, business models that existed prior to the internet. So you don't have to follow that format anymore. Like it just opens so many doors. Like you just said, like there is no you can find ways to explore character, you know, just quirks and little stories, and like you can really start to flesh out like concepts and ideas, and it doesn't have to be what we think of as traditional media and that or even traditional format and length. So yeah, it's really exciting.
So as a capsule, your recommendation is write it, make it, put it out there, see what happens.
Yes.
Like don't just make something to
that's
make,
true
make something that you because you I mean the thing is like we lived with this film for a lot longer than we expected to, but the thing that kept us going through it is that we honestly care about it, and we are trying to do everything in our power to make an actual good movie, both in like from the technical side, but also from the narrative and the characters. Like, we wouldn't be making this if we didn't think we were doing something worth our time. So if you're going to spend the time and you're going to put the energy into something, like, make sure it's something you actually love.
And also, I would say that energy compounds over time. So if, like, yeah, we worked on this for almost like 4.5 or whatever years.
It's been a while.
And I look at it as if we didn't put that energy and time from the get-go, you know, like you might at one point down the process be like, this movie isn't worth finishing. And so like it is like a daily investment of, if you're in it for the long haul, to get a project done. But I feel like if you suddenly start operating at 50% and like, you're kind of like, just blowing through a few things, like, oh, that location's not great, but let's just shoot there anyway. Those kind of things have an effect on you down the line, where now you're editing and doing posts. And it's like your motivation, your interest, your passion for the project is diminished because, you know, you don't have a great looking location because you kind of skimped on that. You didn't hold out and find the right place, or you didn't find the right actor. So all of those things have a net effect on you if you kind of cut corners anywhere. So you got to just be really selective with where you you have to be selective in where you decide to cut corners, because you do in any kind of budgetary environment, you have restrictions. So you just you have to be really smart about that, because if you do it in the wrong place, it will diminish your motivation down the road to complete the project and invest the right energy into it.
Well, Don, Jeff, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Summer.
The movie is Pterodactyl, and we will have details available as soon as we have them.
Yeah.
Where people can go see it. Like I said, the teasers look hilarious, and as long as everyone's having fun, that's what counts, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you. Wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa. The first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award. With weekly stories from the world's best authors. Michael Moorcock. Peter Watts. Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more. With news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pohl, Wolf, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
Well, I've said it a number of times before, and I'm sure I will keep saying it far, far into the future. We need more campy monster movies. We need a lighter selection of B-movies. Doesn't matter if they're creature features or horror movies, there needs to be a middle ground. Because, you know me, I like dark and gritty. But after a while, you just need some silliness to brighten up the place. And I hope this movie turns out to be another addition to the bright, campy silliness that we all enjoy. And I really do have a soft spot for pterodactyls. I didn't realize how much a pterodactyl connected me with the childhood joy of playing with my dinosaurs. I wish I still had some of those dinosaurs. From what I recall, they were very unique. They were very heavy. They were pretty substantial, anywhere from 4 inches to 7 inches in size. There was a whole entire set of them, and they were, for me, they were perfect because the way they were colored. They weren't dinosaur colored. And having grown up near the Smithsonian, I know what dinosaurs were, the artist depiction of them in their natural habitats were. But these toys, and you know, they were a handful for a kid, a grade school kid, they were purple and blue. Like if you looked at them in the light a certain way, they were a really rich royal blue, and if you turn them in the light a different way, they were purple. And that shifting color pattern just always fascinated me as much as the detail on the actual dinosaurs themselves. I really, really wish I still had them. I have no idea where they got off to. I would bet money they are under the stairs in my mom's basement somewhere. But I would like to thank Don and Jeff for following their dream. It took them almost five years to make this movie, and they kept at it. That's dedication to a dream. And I think all of us who have gotten discouraged at some point in time can take a little hope from that. So there are links now. The distribution company has announced its availability. It will be coming out on DVD in the UK in April and in the US in June. There are links on the website, sliceofscifi.com. Go check out the trailer. Go check out their Facebook page, follow their Twitter feed. They're still having fun with this. And that's what making stories for other people to enjoy should be all about. But yes, Pterodactyl coming your way to a late night popcorn fest at your own place or someone else's. But that will do it for this episode of Slice of Sci-Fi. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. What's my phone number again? Oh yeah, 602-635-6976. Leave us a voicemail or go right ahead and send me an email with something you've recorded yourself. That email address is summer@sliceofscifi.com. I got more than a few people emailing and calling in after after Sony made their announcement about PlayStation View being available for cord cutters like me. And the more I look at it, the more I'm really, really intrigued by it. And I may just have to save up and buy myself an Amazon Fire TV and try out PlayStation View for, I think it's a 30-day free trial or 7-day free trial, something like that, for their basic package. And I may have to jump into that pool. So we shall see. And thank you to everyone who bombarded me with voicemail messages and emails saying, hey, remember that TV rant you were talking about? Check out Sony with their PlayStation View. So thank you. Really, I appreciate it. And yes, my TV watching has been spotty, but I have recently started binging on Lucifer, which is on Hulu right now. That's a really fun show. Why didn't anybody tell me about that sooner? And Sci-Fi Channel sent me the best press kit ever. I'm serious. This is the king of all binging press kits that I've ever received. The kit is compact. It contains a Blu-ray, the official Blu-ray of season one of 12 Monkeys, plus DVDs for the screeners for the first 8 episodes of season 2. So I can be 12 monkeyed out, seriously, 12 monkeyed out in no time. And I'm looking forward to sitting down and binging on that. For upcoming shows, we have Winona Earp, we have Hunters, we have the season finale of The Magicians coming up soon, I believe. And Stitchers. Stitchers season 2 starts also very, very soon. April, I believe. No, that's next week. Yeah, March 22nd, I believe, is the first episode of season 2. Really, really looking forward to that. And tell me what you're looking forward to for spring season television. And the upcoming movies, too. And maybe we can get some discussions going all over who's watching what. I know Darren and Noah are very, very much looking forward to checking out Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, which is coming up this coming week. And we will have their review for you as soon as they get finished scooping themselves up from the puddle of glee that they are expecting to be after seeing that movie. As always, if you are enjoying the show, leave a review for us on iTunes. Let other people know that there's some other sci-fi entertainment out there that they have either forgotten about or didn't know about. So go ahead and do that. Also, check us out on Twitter, at Slice of Sci-Fi. Check us out on Google+, Slice of Sci-Fi. I really don't know the status of the Facebook page. I'll have to go look, but it's out there. Slice of Sci-Fi on Facebook. As always, the website is sliceofscifi.com. Come on by, leave us a comment on this show, on any other shows that we have put out there. We have some new reviews coming your way, hopefully, for sliceofscifi.com and writersafterdark.com, and also, I believe, popculturegeeks.com. So keep an eye out there for some commentary and reviews on TV shows, movies, books, the works. As always, your donations are welcome. Thank you very much for your support. You are keeping the website and the shows available online for you and everyone else to enjoy. You can add your support as a patron over at patreon.com. That's patreon.com/sliceofscifi. Just follow the links from the website. And as always, your contributions, your donations, your support in any way, shape, or form is greatly appreciated. As always, I'd love to thank my boys, Cy Fried, for the theme music. If you want to check out more geek rock by them, their website is cy-friedband.com, and tell them Summer sent ya. But that will conclude our entertainment for today. I think I may go see if I have any way of watching Godzilla and Rodan. I really do. I really want to see that movie again right now. But we'll be back again with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.